Okay, hope everyone's back. So imagine a still mountain pool that has a mirror-like surface, no ripples at all. Then we take a stone or a pebble and throw it into the middle of that pond. This is splash, and the ripples emanate out. And we all know this experience. And think of this as a model of dependent origination, but more personally, a model of how we create this sense of me, this sense of self, this sense of you also. This is the same process we create self and other. So the pond represents our consciousness, our history, our predispositions, all these earlier stages of dependent origination that we talked about, the sankharas and the name and form and all those qualities, the sense of sense gates, all those things form this sense of pond. So it's a receptiveness, but yet it's already biased. It's already predisposed to receive information a certain way. And then the pebble represents a moment of sense contact, one of the six senses of sight, of hearing, of know, of smelling, of taste, of touch, and of thought. So the pond is ready to receive it, and the contact happens. Now, by itself, the pebble, the sense data is completely neutral. Yet we add something to it, and then this what we add to it is the splash, the ripples, which is our liking, our disliking, our movement toward, a movement away. This is our longing, our desire, our lust, our dislike, our reactivity, our hatred. This becomes the bedrock that creates this conditioned sense of me, the sense of self. And yet the me is already inherent in the makeup of the pond. It's already kind of pre-built into it, predisposed. So these two combine, the predisposition and the creation of self, is what creates dukkha, as outlined and by the Four Noble Truths, by dependent origination. Now, the thing that creates the contact, the actual sound, the actual sensation, is neutral. It's just a sound. It's just a taste. It's just a smell. But we always add something to it. We add something as simple as our name, our label to it. We know what that is. We identify it. We try to place it in our memory, in our history. Whenever I experienced this or something like this before, should I like it or dislike it? And then from then we move into reactivity. This is the rest of the year going into dependent origination. I believe it was a Thai meditation master who was talking to a student who was complaining about the noise outside the meditation hall and the jackhammers or the traffic noise. And the teacher said, is the noise bothering you, or are you bothering the noise? Is the sound bothering you, or are you bothering the sound? This is a simple way of describing how we take something neutral like sound and add this whole reactivity to it. Really, we add this whole world that we've been exploring this last month. Now, of course, some stones are more impactful than others. You know, sometimes it's a very subtle quality, like a raindrop. Sometimes it's more like a pebble with a bigger splash, or a stone, or a tree falling into it. These are the impacts of some news which may be very painful to hear, some painful sensation in our bodies. You know, it's not to diminish the effects of this impact. So there's can be bigger and bigger splashes, bigger reactions, and bigger senses of self. It's bigger as in more convincing. Now, I've described this just as as a still pond with one splash, and that's all it is. But in reality, we have multiple splashes, multiple pebbles coming in constantly. It's like we're living in a hailstorm with our consciousness being bombarded by sense data. And usually we ignore and filter out most of it. We just key on some that create this sense of me. We're so caught up in those ripples and splashes. You write it. It's too busy writing out the waves to see all the subtle splashes around until the next contact arises that engages us. This really describes our normal existence, the normal sense of being in the world. The sense of me is there, of course, waiting to be triggered, waiting to be engaged by some sense contact, including thinking. Right? How often do we just spend hours thinking upon thought, the world of papancha? The thought arises, our sense of self is triggered around it, and we have another thought, and that triggers it again. This is understanding the creation of dukkha, the origin of dukkha. But the Buddha also talked about the cessation of dukkha, the sensation of suffering. So what he was saying is this whole process that I've just been describing with this analogy of the pond is actually optional, is actually doesn't have to happen. And seeing how that can be released is the pathway that he laid out, that he discovered and he taught for those 40 years, and that his students taught all the way down through the years, through the ages. And certainly we still have suffering. We have the Buddha suffered with physical pain and emotional pain, but there's this added on suffering, the suffering of the angst, of the distress that falls away. That's all tied to this identification, the sense of me. So when we have this, usually we live in this sense of the pond, feeling these ripples and expanding out. This is what we expect is going to happen. I throw a ball in the air and I expect the ball to come back down. I throw a stone into the pond, I expect a splash, and I expect to see the ripples. Now what if that stone passes right through the pond without a ripple, without a splash? It's like it's passing through vapor, through something illusionary, that there's nothing solid to meet it, to touch it, to react to it. There's no sense of me to receive it. Then what happens? This is what the Buddha said around this, that just as if there were a roofed house or a roofed hall having windows in the north, the south, or the east, when the sun rises and a ray has entered by way of the window, where does it land? Where does it land? Where does that stone land? When the student responding says, it lands on the western wall. And if there's no western wall, where does it land? On the ground. And if there is no ground, where does it land? On the water. And if there is no water, where does it land? It does not land. And in the same way, the Buddha said, there's no passion, there's no clinging, there's no contact. There's no sorrow, no affliction, no despair. This is what happens when there's not that sense of self predisposed to receive sense data. This is the direction of our practice. To understand, yes, how we create this sense of self, how we create this suffering. But equally important is to see the end of that suffering, to see what happens when that falls away. This weekend, on 4th of July, I went hiking with my family up in the subalpine area, and there was snow on the ground. And as those of you who have done that, you know, you can walk along the snow, and it's sturdy and supportive, and then you step on something that's actually been hollowed out. So it looks like it's solid, but it's actually very thin, and your foot plunges through unexpectedly, and there's a startle, there's a surprise in that passing through. And this is what can often happen when, through different conditions, through your practice, that moment, that stone passes right through. A sense data arises, and our sense of self doesn't arise with that. And we're aware of that. We're conscious to that. There's actually many moments during the day when a contact arises, and our sense of self doesn't arise with it. We just tend to not notice that because we're so busy latching on and dealing with the senses of self which are engaged, that are being triggered. So when this falls away, sometimes it can be unsettling, disorienting. Sometimes it can be just a place of tremendous wonder and joy, and often a mixture of these two. Because when that sense of that sense of the pebble passing through without resistance, without that sense of me having to do something with it. There's a release of our ground. There's a release of our orientation, a framework that we've really lived our whole life based upon. You know, much of our practice is learning to quiet those ripples. And there's ripples of reactivity, of engagement, of worry, of strife, of longing, to just simply meet the experience just how it is, not how we wish it was. And then so the years of practice that this often requires, we start to just quiet down those ripples. There is more and more stillness to a point that when that pebble lands, it actually doesn't land. It goes right through. It passes through. And when that happens, it may happen spontaneously. It's not of our will, of our doing. We can't make that happen. It's like there's this surprise. You know, something we've expected to be there is no longer there. Stones are supposed to make a splash and cause ripples. I'm supposed to have an opinion about the moment. I'm supposed to be reactive. I'm supposed to do something with it, to struggle with it, to get more of, get less of. And so when this arises in our practice, the fruition of our practice, it feels like a free fall, like being on a roller coaster that keeps dropping without any end in sight, or an elevator. The very ground falls away. And this may just be a few moments of this, as say, oh wow, that I just suddenly experienced this moment without me. Or maybe a more prolonged sense of this. The Buddha described this in a very beautiful way. That consciousness without feature, without end, luminous all around, here water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing. Here long and short, coarse and fine, fair and foul, name and form, all brought to an end. With the sensation of the activity of consciousness, each is here brought to an end. This is how so many of the paradoxical statements of Zen make sense, the pointing towards something of contrast. Where long and short have no form, where water, earth, and fire, and wind have no footing. It doesn't make any sense from this normal worldview, this normal perspective of me in relationship to everything else. To me with my opinions, my desires, my dislikes. It doesn't make any sense. But yet if we're able to soften that sense of me, let that thin, as Rodney spoke about in January, letting that quiet, even to some degree, we start to get a taste of this paradox, which can't be held in our mind, our normal mind. It requires us to let go in a profound, deep way. And in this way, this sense of disorientation, this sense of fear and unease with this lack of ground becomes an important signpost to learn to turn toward, become interested and curious with, to try to transform that disorientation to wonder, to release our need for control, to relax into the spontaneous arising of life. Relax into to really just surrender into the wonder, the mystery of life unfolding. And yes, yeah, there's a releasing of our control, of our knowing. But that in itself is an illusion. I mean, how many of us predicted 2020 would be like this? Talking with each other over the internet instead of in person. How many things that we've held so dear have shifted, have changed because of the current situation. We have this illusion of control, of certainty, and we, you know, we're humans, are fairly good at you know, orchestrating our comfort and our success. But yet, if we really look, things are constantly arising unexpectedly. And the gist of the problem, really, the question is: do we argue with that, or do we celebrate it? Do we relax with it? one teacher described it as, you know, a free falling, and how there can be the panic and the fear of that. And then you pass someone who is just laid back and relaxed and actually enjoying the free fall and saying, yeah, it just keeps going. Just sit back and relax. Suzuki Roshi was said to have this sense of almost surprise as each moment revealed itself to him, as the stone passed through the moments of contact, of sense data passed through without himself arising, without himself predisposed to receive that. And as we hear this, we often have this sense, well, how can I live my life if I'm not in the midst of it, if I'm not everything oriented back to me? And of course, the sense of self, there's an element of the delusion that falls away. But the navigational self, this phrase that Christina Feldman used a number of years ago, is very helpful to remember. We still know how to do our jobs. We still know how to navigate through life. But yet we still also know that this sense of self, it's just a tool that we pick up. And it's true, much of our normal motivation starts to not make sense, that sense of drivenness that we often carry into our success and our lives. Doesn't make us, as impulse to move gets changed, it gets transformed. We have to be patient to allow something else to arise, something else to move us. That's outside of our will, outside of our agenda. So just to go back to that Bahia Sutta that we use for the meditation. So then Bahia, and so remember Bahia was the seeker who wanted to find his way through his delusion, his suffering, and sought the Buddha out with much urgency. And the Buddha finally relented and gave him the teachings in a very direct, clear way. Then Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will only be the seen. He goes on to say, in reference to the heard, to the sensed, to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. So for when you, there is only be the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard, only the sensed, only the cognized, then Bahia, there's no you in connection with that. There's no you in connection with that. And when there's no you in connection with that, there's no you there. When there's no you there, you're neither here nor yonder, nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of dukkha. This phrase, this is such a direct pointing, and yet it's very paradoxical. It doesn't make sense unless we allow ourselves to release something very fundamental and deep. So I'd like to invite us into an exploration of this directly through dyads. And before everybody, the people would jump off, I'd like to just say that some options are, if you'd rather not do a dyad, you're welcome to just stay on the line and not participate. You can just sit quietly, and they'll come back to some general questions after that.
Part of the exercise we did, and it was okay. And the second part, we started, and I didn't stick with it because it felt like it was pro forma, if that's the right word. It felt like, so if I felt heaviness on my legs where I was not, the answer was heaviness, because that was the contact.
Yes.
And it seemed like that I sort of intellectually knew what the answer should be. So either I was going to say that, or I was going to try not to say that. And it was just too much like, oh, it's not working. So, and I won't reveal my partner because I don't want to get that person in trouble. So for the second half, we just kind of talked about it, and it was great. It was a good conversation, but so the second part didn't work for me.
Yes, yeah, thank you for sharing that, Iris. You know, certainly that second question, you know, where are you not? If it really worked for you, you wouldn't have anything to say. It'd be like, I'm not here. I mean, it's like you could start to see that edge of try to say something. This is where I am. I'm creating the sense of me to say that.
Exactly.
To orient enough to say it.
So you tricked us.
Maybe. I think, you know, sometimes Vipassana teachers, we kind of lay it out too easily. One teacher said, a good Vipassana talk, everything's really clear. And a good Zen talk, you're really confused at the end because it's all paradoxical. Mm. And I think that, you know, sometimes we undervalue the benefit of struggle in our culture. You know, that struggle of like, just, I don't understand this. And I get, you know, I keep trying to knock on that door and have it open. And I just, I don't know what this means. But that in itself reveals something. It shows you, you know, really somatically or, you know, viscerally how embedded that perspective is and how deeply something has to shift to be able to go out of that. So I, from my perspective, I think it worked well. It may not have felt good, but it was a learning with that, especially if you saw that, oh, I can't, how can I say anything without forming a sense of self? Yeah, that's why, yeah, the words so often fail us. Thank you, Iris.
So, Tim, this is Gary.
Hi, Gary.
So I'll preface it by saying I had a great partner and I like dyads. But I have never had so much fun in a dyad before. I don't know if it was what it particularly was, but even on the second question, which I know is very challenging, I just felt a sense of peace, enjoyment, somewhat of confusion, but it just was a amazing experience. So I'll leave it at that because I can't quite put it into words. But it was very deep and thoughtful, and thank you.
You're very welcome, Gary. I'm glad that worked well for you and your partner. Sometimes the dyads can take us to, you know, when I've done them, it often feels like I'm in the middle of a retreat. You know, it's just like it allows us to access a deeper understanding, a deeper presence. Because I think it's so often so hard for us to keep our direction, our attention on a particular course. Like we think, okay, I'm gonna notice where I'm arising, and then suddenly we're thinking about what's for dinner or what I have to do tomorrow. And our partner just keeps patiently asking us again. So it kind of keeps us to see, okay, I've asked that same question many times, and then something else arises, something surprising, something that hasn't been seen. So it's like a way of our partner's support allows us to see through our layer of unconsciousness, of delusion that keeps us turning away, getting distracted, you know, being not diving as deeply as we can. So thank you for sharing that, Gary.
Hey, Tim, I'll just share. I think we had a similar experience in the second question where it felt like pretty profound, actually, where the energy kind of came up. And then there was just a lot more space, and it felt like a greater sense of presence, even though it was harder to answer the actual thing. I just felt like there was more, there was somehow like a greater sense of vibrancy or something of like more like of a just a felt sense of presence.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Beautiful. So that felt sense of presence that can be, kind of part of the phrase from therapy, that felt sense, that felt experience of presence that's really outside of the sense of me. Because sometimes we have an idea that if the sense of me falls away, there's this void and this negative, you know, balance, you know, absence, like the deepness of space, right? Yet when the sense of self falls away, there's still this deep sense of presence. In some ways is even, in basically always, is much more present, much more available, much more intimate with whatever is arising without that sense of me. And you can see how the me, we have to generate that to create a little bit of distance, a little bit of friction with this moment. And so that ability to kind of shift out of that is it's very available. And we're able to touch that for many of us in a series of questions in 20 minutes. It's actually something that's available just in moments. All we have to do in the moment is ask, okay, I see where I am. Where am I not? You know, what is the presence that's not of me? Whatever question really lands and invites that forth. And that's this beautiful paradox that we spend often years seeking something that's been over our left shoulder all along. And all we had to do was stop looking and simply allow it to reveal itself. Yeah, thank you, David.
Tim?
Yes.
I just wanted to follow up on that. I found the second question provoked a sort of an intellectual storm in me. And so I got pretty, a little desperate thinking, well, where am I not? But it never occurred to me if I'm, it's kind of just coming clear right now. It never occurred to me if I'm not all these places that I'm thinking I am or could be or am prohibited from being or whatever, well, then I must be here. I must be present. So that's pretty cool, actually.
Yes. Yeah, and that's similar to the first comment around, you know, that question can generate a lot of kind of noise in some ways and distress. And that's the sense of self. It's like the cat trying to catch its own tail. It's like you have to go really, really fast and never catch it. And so sometimes that sense of, okay, where am I not? It's like the mind can get very active in finding that. And that very, you can see that actually the opposite of that is the stillness. So sometimes we need that contrast, that quality of turbulence and then see, okay, the release of that is where the answer is revealed.
Thank you.
Sometimes it reveals ourself, you know, we've been looking and looking and looking and trying to find where that sense of me is and where the absence of me is, and just feels so frustrating. And then somehow we suddenly relax and it reveals itself through just the mind shifts, something lets go, you hear someone say something and it suddenly clicks and makes sense. And that's such a benefit of us sharing like this, is that we support each other in our own awakening. Our awakening supports each other equally as our own. All right, anyone else would like to share or comment or ask any questions?
Tim, this is Gary again.
Hi, Gary.
I do have a question for you, not on the dyads, but on a little bit of your talk before.
Okay. Go ahead.
You were mentioning you know, the rocks thrown into the pond.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering from your experience over the years, you know, there's two things. There's a reaction to the rocks, right? Of are you going to let them sink, or are you going to react to them? But there's also the question of how many rocks are being put into the pond. And I guess I'm just truly curious of, as you have increased your meditation practices, are the number of rocks getting thrown into your pond lessened over time, or are they the same and you just react to them less?
Yeah, so if I could play with the analogy a little bit here. Yep. And maybe clarify a couple of the points there around that. So the pond represents, you know, our state of consciousness, you know, our receptivity, and also the bias that's inherent in that consciousness. You know, what we've been exploring these last six, seven months. The rock or the stone is just the point of contact. So it could be, you know, could be hearing a bird, it could be stubbing my toe, it could be hearing a voice. So any of the six senses, including thought. So, you know, five of those senses just kind of depend upon, you know, what environment I'm in. Certainly the thought part of it, that does quiet down. You know, our minds start to, there's this turning that our minds start, because usually we come to practice and we're really almost addicted to thought. We really like to think, we're really, you know, just get engaged in that. So there's a sense of how it feeds us, it drives us, and also it punishes us too with our negative thoughts. And just there's this relationship too that's very, very enmeshed. There's a point in practice where we start to become less and less enmeshed. And our minds actually start to prefer quiet, prefer the stillness. And that's often, you know, through insights, through understandings, through seeing more and more clearly, particularly the deeper drives of our thought, the deeper sankharas, the deeper patterns that create more and more proliferation of thought, we start to see that as empty. And so that starts to fall away. That's also helped by how we work with our reactivity. That's when the stone hits, there's ripples and splashes that come out, are the reactivity that comes from that. That's what we're going to explore from this month on, going into Vedana, the feeling tone, and the next month, Tuari will take on craving and then clinging and then going on to becoming. From the dependent origination standpoint, that's this series of reactivity, being identified. But as practitioners, we learn to say, okay, I'm feeling reactive to this experience, my pain in my knee. And instead of getting really upset about it, I learned to say, okay, let me just turn toward that with curiosity, with compassion, and simply meet that discomfort. That in itself starts to slow down those ripples, make them more thin, less thick. And that in turn predisposes us next time that knee pain arises, the next time that particular stone comes into that pond, there's less of a impulse to have ripples come from it. So over time, it slows down the whole process. So there's less and less reactivity because we've been less reactive in the past. And we're also transforming, hopefully in a deep way, really transforming our ignorance around really the three characteristics of impermanence, of dukkha, and of non-self. Does that help, Gary? There's a big mouthful there.
No, that was good. I think the biggest thing that I, you know, took from that with the six senses is like stubbing your toe and the thought really can be the same thing as how you react to it, in a sense.
Yes. I mean, that's how we experience it, that the stubbing the toe and how we react to it are usually one and the same. But yet, if we look closely, there's actually a little bit of a space. And starting next week, we'll go into this Vedana. And that's that little bit of space, that there's the contact and there's a sense of it being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And from there, we go down the course of wanting or not wanting, which goes into more reactivity. But usually we confuse those two. We confuse the actual sensation with what's we added to it. And it's interesting, like stubbing your toe, there's often that first stub and you feel the pain, the waves of pain, and maybe there's the reaction. If you come back and just feel it directly, and okay, I'm going to let the ranting go and just actually connect with it. You're going to be curious about the waves of sensation and the waves of movement through the body. If you stop reacting to it, there's actually a way of meeting it. And this applies equally to emotional pain, mental pain. All right, thank you, Gary. All right, maybe time for one question or so. All right, looks like we are full tonight. So next week, we'll move into Vedana, which is the next link in dependent origination. The way this worked with the month, I decided to do a talk again the end of June that we're doing the discussion, but we'll go into the cycle of talk next week and then a discussion and the talk again. Suze will be subbing for me on the discussion night. So she'll offer a short talk, which will be, I think, very helpful. And just a couple quick announcements. This week, we have two things arising. One is the intro class, introduction to meditation. So we don't teach meditation in these Monday nights. We do a little bit on the Sunday nights, but there's a formal 6-week course that we've been doing for many years, over 20 years. And I do that about 4 times a year. And so if you would like to have a refresher on your meditation training and skills, please consider attending. Or if you know someone who is interested, starts this Thursday at 7:00, be online, and there's information on the website. And then on Saturday, the 11th, the Climate Action Group will be offering looks like a 4-hour meeting on Zoom on reflecting on the climate crisis, guilt, despair, love, connection, opening to the full catastrophe. And I know they've been working very hard on this and have a lot of great things to present and explore. It starts at 10:00 and goes till 2:00. And you will see more information about that on the website. And finally, I'll send a link for Donna. Thank you for your Donna support for Sims and for myself. And there's some you can copy that and kind of pull out the particulars if you'd like. All right, I look forward to seeing you next week and have a lovely first full week of July. All right, be well.